Since I've been here, we have tried our best to, even down in Chesterfield, to recognize those who are in active duty in our armed forces. In fact, when we came here 10 years ago in August upcoming, I propagandized the board for a flag island, and it was incorporated into the original construction of this building. And we have the American flag, the Missouri flag, and then we have a third flag primarily used for the flags of the different military services. And the flag that we choose to fly there oftentimes has to do with those who are deployed. And so we have been flying the Navy flag for a pretty good while because Jennifer Leeshight has been on active duty floating around the Pacific Ocean in some boat she's got. And she's in town probably on leave for a while. And we're happy to have her in our congregation today. We have a special presentation for her. And we have a guy that actually served in the United States Navy. He was a submariner and a yeoman. And the yeoman is a guy who keeps good records. And so Gary Watson, being a yeoman, obviously is the guy who gets to push pencils for the Board of Deacons as its secretary. So I'm going to ask Gary and Jay to come forward, if you will, to the microphone. And Jennifer, if you would come down front, darling. She is active duty, the United States Navy, and these gentlemen here have a presentation.
In answer to Gary's question, Gary's the pretty one, in case you were wondering.
But this, like Joe said, this flag is something we try to fly in honor of those who are deployed. We don't always do it exclusively because there are certain times that we have to rotate them depending on the month, the year, and the branch that has to be displayed. But this particular flag, I recommend you don't take it out, because if you do, you're going to find that it's very sun-faded and very tattered. But on your recent deployment, you probably that's kind of emblematic for what you've been through, because you don't always sail on calm days and calm seas. So I thought it was a fitting tribute. Gary, congratulations, Jim.
We fly the Navy flag because I was in the Navy. We fly it all the time. That's why it's tattered. It never comes down. So, Jennifer, you could tell, what ship are you on?
The America.
And did you just return from deployment recently?
In February, yes.
And what do you do in the Navy?
I'm a firefighter, basically a damage controlman for the ship.
Do you work for a good chief?
Yes.
What about a senior chief? I know this senior chief. He's not very nice. I'm not going to mention his name, but...
No, we used to have a senior chief. We have a chief now, but...
Much better.
Wait.
Much better. From Grace Doctrine Church, thank you so much for your service, for being here today.
Thank you, Jennifer, for your service. Thank you, gentlemen. We will now pause for a few moments of silent prayer. You may use the time for rebound if necessary. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the opportunity to continue our study of our founders. We thank you for who and what they were, what they endured, and what they accomplished. May we be motivated by their perseverance. We lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen. Number 8 on our list is from the state of Delaware. His name is Caesar Rodney, born in Dover. This is in the year 1730. He was descended from English ancestry. His grandfather came from England soon after William Penn commenced the settlement of Philadelphia. After remaining a short time in Philadelphia and forming acquaintances with some of its most esteemed citizens, he went into the county of Kent on the Delaware and settled down upon a plantation. He was an active man and becoming very popular. He had many posts of honor and distinction in that province. He had several sons, but lost them all except for his youngest, Caesar, the father of the subject of this memoir. Unambitious of public honors and preferring the quiet and domestic life of the bustle and turmoil of the political field, he declined all offices that were tendered to him, and in the midst of agricultural pursuits, he enriched his mind by study and prepared his children for the duties of life. He married the daughter of an esteemed clergyman, and Caesar, being the firstborn, received their special attention in the matter of education of the mind and heart. On the death of his father, Mr. Rodney, as the eldest male heir, inherited the paternal estate, and with it, the distinguished consideration with which the family had ever been regarded. When the Stamp Act excited the jealousy and alarm of the colonies, Mr. Rodney boldly proclaimed his sentiments in opposition to it, and several antecedent acts of injustice which the British government had inflicted upon her colonies in America. He acted as well as he thought and spoke, and when the Stamp Act Congress met in New York in 1765, Mr. Rodney, together with Mr. Thomas McKean and Mr. Rollock, were chosen delegates thereto by unanimous vote. Mr. Rodney was a member of the Provincial Assembly in 1769 and was chosen its speaker. He continued a member and speaker of that body until 1774, and as chairman of the corresponding committee, he was arduous in plying his pen in the interchange of political sentiments with his compatriots in other colonies. He was elected a delegate to the General Congress by a convention of the people of the three counties of Delaware in August 1774 and took his seat at the opening of Congress on the 5th of September following. His colleagues were Thomas McKean and George Read, and three more devoted and active men than these could hardly be found. He was one of a committee to draw up a Declaration of Rights and set forth in an address the causes for complaint and under which the colonists groaned. Mr. Rodney was elected a delegate for 1775, and while attending to his duties in Congress, he was appointed Brigadier General of his province. He was alternately in Congress and at home, attending to the latter place to the duties of his military station. He was there during the closing debates upon the proposition for the Declaration of Independence in 1776, but was sent for by his colleague, Mr. McKean, so as to secure the vote of Delaware for that important measure. He arrived in time to give his voice for independence and enjoyed the high privilege of signing the revered parchment. In the autumn of 1776, the people of Delaware called a convention to frame a state constitution and to elect delegates to the next Congress. Through the machinations of Tory members of that convention, whose principles to a great extent leavened it, Mr. Rodney and Mr. McKean were not reelected. He joined the main army of Washington when the British, under Lord Howe, landed at the mouth of the Elk River and directed their march toward Philadelphia. General Howe, finding it impractical to reach Philadelphia by land, embarked his troops on board the British fleet, then lying off Sandy Hook, and proceeded to the Chesapeake Bay. His troops were landed at the mouth of the Elk River on the 25th of August, 1777, and that was the first intimation Washington had of his real destination. The British immediately commenced their march toward Philadelphia, and the Americans at the same time marched from that city to meet them. They met upon the River Brandywine, where the battle of that name, so disastrous to Americans, occurred. It was there that Lafayette, French aristocrat who fought with the American colonists against the British in the American Revolution, in July 1777, he arrived in Philadelphia. Appointed a major general by the colonists, he quickly struck up lasting friendships with the American commander-in-chief, George Washington. And so it was there that Lafayette greatly distinguished himself and was severely wounded. Not long after this event, Toryism became so much in the minority that it had but little power to oppose the Patriots, and General Rodney was again elected to Congress. While thus laboring for his country's good, Mr. Rodney suffered greatly from the effect of a disease that had been upon him from his youth. Feeling conscious that he was wasting away, He retired from public life and calmly awaited the summons for departure to the spirit land. He died early in the year of 1783, when in the 53rd year of his age. From the colony of Maryland, William Paca was a descendant of a wealthy planter on the east shore of Maryland. He was born at Whitehall, his paternal residence, in the year 1740. His early moral and intellectual training was carefully attended to, and at a proper age, he was placed in the Philadelphia College, whence he graduated, after a course of arduous and profitable study, with great credit to himself. He then commenced the study of the law with Mr. Hammond and Mr. Hall of Annapolis and Samuel Chase, his subsequent congressional colleague, was a fellow student. Mr. Paca was admitted to the bar at the age of 20. In the next year, in 1761, he was chosen a member of the Provincial Assembly. When the Stamp Act in 1765 aroused the people of the colonies to their common danger, Mr. Paca, with Mr. Chase and Mr. Charles Carroll, warmly opposed its operation. Every succeeding measure of the British government, asserting its right to tax the Americans without their consent, was fearlessly condemned by him, and thus he soon obtained the disapprobation of the royal governor of the province and of those who adhered to the king and parliament. Like Mr. Chase, he became very popular with the people by his patriotic conduct. He was appointed by a state convention of Maryland, one of its five representatives in the Continental Congress, who were instructed to, quote, agree to all measures which might be deemed necessary to obtain a redress of American grievances. Mr. Paca was reelected in 1775, and continued a member of Congress until 1778. That was when he was appointed Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of his state. Like Mr. Chase, Mr. Paca was much embarrassed in Congress by the opposition of his constituents to independence and their loyal adherence to the British Crown, as manifested in their instructions, frequently repeated in the early part of 1776. The people of Maryland, as represented in its state convention, were alarmed lest their enthusiastic delegates should favor independence, and early in 1776, they sent them instructions in which they forbade their voting for such a measure. They also passed a resolution that Maryland would not be bound by a vote of a majority of Congress to declare for independence. But on the 28th of May, a remarkable change in their opinions took place, and they ceased praying for the king and royal family. Toward the latter part of June, the convention finished its evolutions by a right-about face and withdrew their restrictions upon the votes of their delegates. Thus relieved, Mr. Paca and his associates continued their efforts to effect a declaration of independence with more zeal than ever, and recorded their votes for the severance of the political bond of union with Britain and the 4th of July following. On the 2nd of August, they fearlessly affixed their signatures to the parchment. In 1788, he was a member of the Convention of Maryland, called to act upon the ratification of the federal Constitution. He was a firm advocate there for its ratification, which event took place in November. After the new Constitution had gone into effect and offices under it were to be filled, President Washington nominated him judge for the District of Maryland. This office he held until the period of his death, which was in the year 1799, when was the 60th year of his age. He was a pure and active patriot, a consistent Christian, and a valuable citizen in every sense of the word. Now we arrive at Virginia. Thomas Nelson, Jr. was born in Yorktown, in Virginia, on the 26th of December of 1738. His father, William Nelson, was a native of England and immigrated to America about the beginning of last century. We have the word immigrated here with an E. It also is spelled with an I. When you are in England and you're coming to the colonies, it's an E because you're leaving where you presently live to go somewhere else. Once you got to the colonies, then it's an I. You're an immigrant when you get here with an I. So if you wonder about the spellings, that's the explanation for that. By prudence and industry, he accumulated a large fortune and held rank among the first families of Virginia. Thomas was the oldest son of his parents, and his father sent him to England at the age of 14 years to be educated. He was placed in a distinguished private school not far from London, and after completing a preparatory course in studies there, he went to Cambridge and was entered a member of Trinity College. He remained there, a close and diligent student, until 1761, when he returned to America. Mr. Nelson watched with much interest the movements of the British Parliament during and after the time of the administration of Mr. George Grenville, and his sympathies were keenly alive in favor of the Americans and their cause. His first appearance in public life was in 1774, when he was elected a member of the House of Burgesses of Virginia, and there he took sides with the Patriots. It was during that session that the resolutions prohibiting the Boston Port Bill, resolutions reprobating the Boston Port Bill caused Lord John Murray Dunmore, the royal governor of Virginia, to dissolve the assembly. 89 of the members, among whom was Mr. Nelson, met the next day at a neighboring tavern and formed an association far more efficient in throwing up the strong bulwarks of freedom than was the regular assembly. So they got it done in a bar. In the spring of 1775, he was elected a member of a general convention, and there he displayed such boldness of spirit that he was looked upon as an efficient leader in the patriotic movements of the day. Much to the alarm of his friends, he proposed that convention, the bold and almost treasonable measure of organizing the militia of the state in defense of the chartered rights of the people. Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, and others warmly seconded the proposition, and it was adopted by the convention. Mr. Nelson was appointed to command of one regiment, Patrick Henry the other, and Richard Henry Lee of another, each holding the rank of colonel. This act told Governor Dunmore that his royal master, in language that could not be mistaken, that Virginia was determined to exercise with freedom all the privileges guaranteed to her by the British Constitution. It was not long before the wisdom of those military movements became apparent, for the royal governor of Virginia, Dunmore, as well as those of some of the other colonies, attempted to secure the powder and other munitions of war in the public magazines under a secret order from the British ministry. This movement clearly divulged the premeditated design of disarming the people and reducing them to slavery. In the spring of 1777, Mr. Nelson was seized with an alarming illness, which confined its attack chiefly to his head and nearly deprived him for a time of his powers of memory. His convalescence was slow, and he resigned his seat in Congress and retired to private life. But he was not suffered long to remain there, for the appearance of a British fleet off the coast of Virginia and the contemplated attack of the enemy upon the almost defenseless seaboard called him into the field at the head of the militia of the state. Mr. Nelson's popularity at the time in Virginia was almost unbounded. The governor and council appointed him brigadier general and commander-in-chief of the military forces of the state. About that time, the financial embarrassments of Congress caused that body to make an appeal to the young men of the Union of wealth and character to aid in recruiting the army and otherwise assisting their country. Mr. Nelson entered heartily into the measure, and by the free use of his influence and purse, he raised a volunteer corps who placed him at their head and proceeded to join Washington at Philadelphia. The sudden call of the militia from their homes left many families in embarrassed circumstances, for a great part of the agricultural operations were suspended. General Nelson also distributed his money liberally among them, and thus more than 100 families were kept from absolute want. In 1781, Virginia became the chief theater of warlike operations. The term of Mr. Thomas Jefferson's official duties as governor of the state expired, and General Nelson was elected his successor. This, however, did not drive him from the field, but as both governor and commander-in-chief of the militia of the state, he placed himself at the head of a considerable force and formed a junction with Lafayette, who had been sent there to check the northward progress of Major General Charles Cornwallis. By great personal exertions and a liberal use of his own funds, he succeeded in keeping his force together until the capture of Cornwallis at Yorktown. He headed a body of militia in the siege of that place, and although he owned a fine mansion in the town, he did not hesitate to bombard it. During the siege, he observed that while the Americans poured their shot and shells thick and fast into every part of the town, they seemed carefully to avoid firing in the direction of his house. Governor Nelson inquired why his house was spared, and was informed that it was out of personal regard for him. He at once begged them not to make any difference on that account, and at once a well-directed fire was opened upon it. At that moment, a number of British officers occupied it and were at dinner, enjoying a feast and making merry with wine. The shots of the Americans entered the house, and killing two of the officers effectively ended the conviviality of that party. Can you imagine these officers while they're under assault? And by the way, they lost that battle in the country. They're in there having a party and a bunch of winos. And this is, in every sense, everything else, Nelson's patriotism was conspicuous, and General Washington, in his official account of the siege, made honorable mention of the great services of Governor Nelson and his militia. Within a month of the Battle of Yorktown, Governor Nelson, finding his health declining, resigned his office and returned to private life. His health gradually declined until 1789, when on the fourth day of January, his useful life closed. He was in the 53rd year of his age. From the colony of North Carolina, Joseph Hughes. The parents of Joseph Hughes were natives of Connecticut and belonged to the Society of Friends, or Quakers. Immediately after their marriage, they moved to New Jersey and purchased a small farm in Kingston, within a short distance of Princeton. It was there that Joseph was born in the year 1730. He was educated at the college in Princeton. You do understand that that became Princeton University. And by the way, Princeton and Harvard were seminaries that were founded as seminaries. He was educated at the College of Princeton, and at the close of his studies, he was apprenticed to a merchant in Philadelphia to qualify him for a commercial life. On the determination of his apprenticeship, his father furnished him with a little money capital, to which he added the less fleeting capital of a good reputation, and he commenced mercantile business on his own account. His business education had to be thorough, and he pursued the labors of commerce with such skill and success that in a few years he amassed an ample fortune. At the age of 30 years, Mr. Hughes moved to North Carolina and settled at Edenton, which became his home for life. He entered into business there, and his uprightness and honorable dealings soon won for him the profound esteem of the people. While yet a comparative stranger among them, they evinced their appreciation of his character by electing him a member of the legislature of North Carolina. That was in 1763. And so faithfully did he discharge his duties that they reelected him several consecutive years. Mr. Hughes was among the earliest of the dedicated patriots of North Carolina and used his influence in bringing about a convention of the people of the state to second the call of Massachusetts for a general Congress. The convention that met in the summer of 1774 elected him one of the delegates for that state in the Continental Congress that met in Philadelphia in September following. He took his seat on the 14th of the month and was immediately placed upon the committee appointed to draw up a Declaration of Rights. During that session, he was actively engaged in maturing a plan for a general non-importation agreement throughout the colonies, and he voted for and signed it. In this act, he devoted patriotism was manifest, for it struck a deadly blow at the business in which he was engaged. It was a great sacrifice for him to make, yet he cheerfully laid it upon the altar of freedom. To forbid any incoming ships from afar, with emphasis on England, meant that he could not sell his products abroad. And so it affected his income markedly, yet he voted for this. Mr. Hughes was again elected a delegate to Congress in 1775 and took his seat at the opening of the 10th of May. He seldom engaged in debate, but as an unwearied committeeman, he performed signal service there. He was head of the Naval Committee and was, in effect, the first Secretary of the Navy of the United States. Mr. Hughes was a member of Congress for 1776, and North Carolina, having early taken a decided stand in favor of independence, his own views upon this question were fully sustained by his instructions, and he voted for and signed the declaration thereof. Soon thereafter, he returned home, for the troubles there demanded his presence, and his private affairs needed his attention to save his fortune from being scattered to the winds. He remained at home until July of 1779, when he returned his seat to Congress. But his constitution, naturally weak, could not support the arduous labors of his station, and his health failed so rapidly that he was obliged to resign his seat. He left it on the 29th of October, 1779, and being too unwell to travel, he remained in Philadelphia. But he only lived 11 days after he left his seat in Congress. He died on the 10th of November following, in the 50th year of his age. He was the first and only one of the signers of the Declaration who died at the seat of government, which was at Philadelphia at that point. His remains were followed to the grave by Congress in a body and a large concourse of citizens in Philadelphia. This is an interesting guy from the colony of South Carolina. His name is Thomas Lynch, Jr. He was born in Prince George's Parish upon the North Santee River, South Carolina, on the 5th day of August of 1749. He was a descendant of an ancient Austrian family, natives of the town of Lentz. A branch of the family moved to England and settled in the county of Kent. Thence they went to Connaught in Ireland, and it was from that place that the great-grandfather of our subject immigrated to America and settled in South Carolina a short time after its first settlement. He purchased large tracts of land, and when they fell into the possession of the father of Thomas Lynch, Jr., they possessed a great value and gave him a splendid fortune. He was a man of great influence, and having early espoused the cause of the colonists, he was elected a delegate to the First Continental Congress, which met in Philadelphia in 1774. He continued a member of that body until his death. Thomas Lynch, Jr. was sent to England to be educated at the age of 13 years. Thomas Lynch was sent to England to be educated at the age of 13 years. He had previously received a good academical education at Georgetown in South Carolina. In England, he was placed in Eton School, that seminary preparation for higher instruction, in which for a long period many eminent men were educated. After completing his preparatory studies there, he entered the University of Cambridge, where he took his degree, and he left the institution bearing the highest respect of the tutors because of his studious and virtuous career while there. On leaving Cambridge, young Lynch entered into the study of the law. He became acquainted with some of the leading politicians of the day and acquired a pretty thorough knowledge of the movements of the government. When he heard the murmur of discontent come from his native land and listened to the haughty tone of British statesmen when speaking of the colonies, he felt an irrepressible desire to return home. He obtained permission of his father and reached South Carolina in 1772. He soon afterward married a beautiful young lady named Shebrick, between whom and himself a mutual attachment had existed from childhood. This tender relation and the possession of an ample fortune were calculated to wed him to the ease and enjoyment of domestic life. But young Lynch had caught the spirit of his patriotic father, and he stood up like a strong young oak to breast the storm of the revolution, then gathering black on every side. Mr. Lynch's first appearance in public life was at a town meeting called in Charleston in 1773 to consider the injuries Great Britain was inflicting on her colonies. He addressed the numerous assemblage with a patriotic eloquence that won their hearts, and the people at once looked upon him an efficient instrument in working out the freedom of his country. They elected him by acclamation to many offices of trust, and when the first provincial regiment was raised in South Carolina in 1775, a captain's commission was offered to Mr. Lynch, which he accepted. In company with Captain, afterward General Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, he made a recruiting excursion into North Carolina to raise the company he was to command. In this service, he was greatly exposed to the inclemencies of the weather, and his health revealed a shock, or rather received a shock, from which it never recovered. He raised his company and joined his regiment, but a few days afterward, intelligence reached him of the sudden and severe illness of his father from paralysis at Philadelphia, and he asked permission to attend him. But Colonel Christopher Gadsden absolutely refused to grant the request on the ground that no private consideration should interfere with public duty. But his filial yearnings were speedily gratified, for his father resigned his seat in Congress, and his son was immediately elected by the Provincial Assembly to fill it. He joyfully accepted it and hastened to Philadelphia, where he took his seat in Congress in 1776. He supported the proposition for independence and was one of the signers to the glorious declaration thereof. Mr. Lynch did not long remain in Congress, for the declining health of both himself and his father caused him to resign his seat and return home. The canker of disease was preying upon his vitals, and by the advice of physicians, he resolved to go to the south of Europe with a faint hope that restored health might be the result. It being perilous at that time to go in an American vessel there, he sailed for the West Indies toward the close of 1779 with the expectation of finding a neutral vessel there in which to embark to Europe. His affectionate wife accompanied him, but they never reached their destination. The vessel was supposed to have foundered at sea, that means it sunk, and all on board perished, for it was never heard of again. Thus, at the early age of 30 years, terminated the life of one of the sacred band who pledged life, fortune, and honor in defense of American freedom. Like a brilliant meteor, he beamed with splendor for a short period and suddenly vanished forever. Of all of the guys, and now this is the third set of 13, I'm not sure, but I think that's 39. The next guy is called Button Gwinnett, Georgia. It is one of the states that only had three representatives at the convention. And so I went through the list of them, and any state that only had three left me no option but to take the remainder. He gets off to a good start, but not a very good end. Button Gwinnett was born in England in 1732. A pecuniary means of his parents were limited, yet they managed to give him a good common education. He was apprenticed to a merchant in Bristol, and after completing his term of service, he married and commenced business on his own account. Allured by the promises of wealth and distinction in America, he resolved to emigrate hither, and he arrived at Charleston in South Carolina in the year 1770. There he commenced mercantile business, and after pursuing it for 2 years, he sold his stock, moved to Georgia, and purchased large tracts of land on St. Catherine's Island in that province. Mr. Gwinnett favored the opposition of the colonies to British oppression to some degree, yet he was one of those cautious, doubting men at that time who viewed the success of the colonies in an open rupture with the home government as highly problematical. Therefore, when in 1774 Georgia was solicited to unite her voice with the other colonies in a general Congress, Mr. Gwinnett looked upon the proposition with disfavor as one fraught with danger and many evils. But falling in with Dr. Lyman Hall and a few other dedicated patriots, his judgment became gradually convinced that some powerful movement was necessary, and at length he came out before the people as one of the warmest advocates of unbending resistance to the British crown. His cultivated mind and superior talents rendered him very popular with the people as soon as he espoused their cause, and every honor in their gift was speedily bestowed upon him. It was at the beginning of 1775 that Mr. Gwinnett openly espoused the cause of the patriots, and the parish of St. John elected him a delegate to the Continental Congress. In February 1776, he was again elected a delegate to that body by the General Assembly of Georgia, and under their instructions and in accordance with his own strong inclinations, he voted for the Declaration of Independence and signed it on the 2nd of August following. He remained in Congress until 1777, when he was elected a member of the convention of his state to form a constitution in accordance with the recommendation of Congress after the declaration was made and grand outlines of that instrument are attributed to Mr. Gwinnett. Soon after the state convention adjourned, Mr. Bullock, the president of the council, died, and Mr. Gwinnett was elected to that station, then the highest office in the gift of the people. The civil honor so rapidly and lavishly bestowed upon him excited his ambition. While he was a representative in Congress, he aspired to the possession of military honors also. He offered himself as a candidate for the office of Brigadier General, and his competitor was Colonel McIntosh, a man highly esteemed for his manly bearing and courageous disposition. Mr. Gwinnett was defeated, and with mistaken views, he looked upon his rival as a personal enemy. At length, he was so goaded by the thoughts of having his fair fame tarnished, challenged Colonel McIntosh to single combat. They met with pistols, and at the first fire, both were wounded, Mr. Gwinnett mortally. And in the prime of life, at the early age of 45, his life terminated. Mr. Gwinnett left a wife and several children, but they did not long survive him. Beginning on July the 4th of 1776, 56 men wrote their signature on the Declaration of Independence, with representatives from all 13 colonies participating. On September 17th of 1787, 40 men signed the Constitution of the United States, with signatories representing 12 of the original 13 colonies participating, with the state of Rhode Island excepted. Of the 56 men who signed the Declaration, Only six affixed their name to the Constitution. Roger Sherman of Connecticut, Robert Morris, Benjamin Franklin, George Clymer, and James Wilson of Pennsylvania, and George Reed of Delaware. Information about each of the 13 men referenced in this study are excerpted from a book first published in 1848 and reprinted in 1995. Publication data of the book, signers of the Declaration of Independence, and a source for its purchase are posted below. This is written by Benson Lossing, Biological Sketches of the Signers of the Declaration of the American Independence. It is available on Amazon with a link below. I want to show you something. This is a tight shot of the Declaration. And the stars indicate the signatories we've noted today. I'll start from the left. Button Gwinnett lost a duel, but he is the star to the left. I'll get a pen here. Joseph Hughes, right here. Thomas Lynch, Jr. William Paca. Thomas Nelson, Jr. George Clymer. Caesar Rodney. This is William Floyd here.